Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane was found guilty by a jury in Montgomery County Court last night on all four criminal charges she faced. Kane is accused of leaking secret grand jury information to a newspaper and then lying about it under oath. In fact, the perjury charges are felonies. Joining us, someone who covered the trial, Pittsburgh Tribune Review columnist Brad Bumstead. He not only covered the trial, he's written a new book called Keystone Corruption Continues, Cash Payoffs, Porngate, and the Kathleen Kane Scandal. Brad Bumstead, welcome to the program.
Scott, thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, Brad, let's talk a little bit later in the week about the book when we have a little more time. But this morning, let's talk about the trial itself. For those, I know that here in the Harrisburg area, there are a lot of people, especially us here in the news media, that have covered this very closely. But for those out there in the audience who may not be familiar with the background, provide a little background, if you would.
Sure. It's, think of one word. It's all about payback. And that's what Kathleen Kane engaged in when she went after Frank Fina, a former state prosecutor, after the Philadelphia Inquirer wrote a damaging story about Kane in March of 2014. Kane suspected that Fina was behind that and planting the story, which he's denied. But in any case, he was firmly in her sights at that point. There was some discussion of that even with one of the witnesses in the testimony, a guy named J.J. Balaban, who is a political consultant. And he suggested, go after Fina, don't go after the Philadelphia Inquirer. And that's exactly what she did by then plotting to leak some additional information about a separate case about a man named J. Wyatt Mondesire, a former NAACP attorney who was also a newspaper publisher of a weekly in Philadelphia. And he'd been under investigation by the Attorney General's office in 2009. The case was under FINA's supervision. It was dropped, and there was no prosecution of Mondesire. And Kane was trying to show that, look, Frank Fina did the same thing that I'm accused of here with the Sting case, which was the legislative payments, cash payoffs to lobbyists, legislators from an undercover lobbyist.
And that's what the Inquirer had written about, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was about. So at this point, the Philadelphia Daily News, which is a competitor, was a competitor of the Inquirer, takes the story about Mondesire. They look into it. They do what they're supposed to do. They publish a really hard-hitting story about Mondesire, and it comes from an illegal leak. Different issue was with the Sting case. That was not a grand jury case. It was just an investigation that was leaked. This, when something is before a grand jury, whether it's for 1 minute or 3 years, it's sacrosanct in the eyes of the law, and it cannot be provided to non-law enforcement people except with a judge's approval. So this goes to the Philadelphia Daily News. They write the story. Mondesire is highly embarrassed by all of this. And guess what? He was never, never arrested. So here you have a guy who had been under investigation but was never charged with a crime, embarrassed and humiliated by the state's chief law enforcement officer. I think that brings us up to date in that Kevin Steele, the Montgomery County District Attorney, used that in his opening the very first thing and talked about how Mondesire had been basically a victim of Kathleen Kane's plot.
But then what's ironic about it is, she was accused of leaking secret grand jury information, but then she is called to testify under oath, and then she allegedly, well, now the jury says she did, that she's guilty, of then lying under oath about it.
Repeatedly. And that was all part of the cover-up. It began with that lie that she plotted with a political consultant of her, a guy named Josh Morrow, who was an unindicted co-conspirator in this case. And the case was sailing along through the week last week until we hit Thursday, and they brought Morrow in to testify, and it was a bombshell. I got to tell you, it blew everybody out of the water. I mean, we knew that maybe he could testify against her, but he comes in and says, look, we plotted, we conspired, we planned to put out this leak, And not only did he come in and say that and accuse her, but there was corroborating evidence. There are his text messages back and forth with Kane where they're plotting it. And there's also an unrelated federal wiretap, which comes out of the blue and has Morrow in there talking about doing this leak that Kane wants.
Now, you just mentioned the most significant testimony of last week, but there were a couple times during the week where some testimony came up that I don't know if it reached the bombshell stage that or the bombshell level of Morrow's testimony, but Adrian King. Talk about Adrian King and the Attorney General of Pennsylvania. He felt the Attorney General of Pennsylvania was trying to frame him.
He did, and he did say that. Adrian King was Kane's first deputy. More than that, he was her boyfriend, and according to him, his testimony, they dated and even lived together after law school at Temple Law School. So he knew her very well. When she's elected attorney general, she asks him, Ballard Spahr law firm partner, to come in. He said he took an 80% pay cut to work for Kane, and he does, and he was her first deputy. But I got to tell you, through the whole Sting case that we talked about, the legislative payoffs, he was a fierce defender of Cooks. I mean, he really was. He described the break with her as occurring where at the end of the first week of the Sting case, she decided to go talk to the Philadelphia Inquirer's editorial board page at his suggestion and others. But what she didn't tell him or other advisors is that she took famed libel attorney Dick Sprague along with her, and Sprague promptly told the Philadelphia editorial board, Inquirer editorial board, that she wasn't going to speak and he would do all the talking for her. Sprague, of course, just even having him there sent a huge message to the Inquirer because he had successfully sued the Inquirer for a multi-million-dollar settlement years ago.
You know, Brad, as you're describing this, and you write about it, as I said in the book, much more, this has all the makings of a soap opera, some kind of movie. It is hard to believe we are talking about the top law enforcement officer in this state.
It really is. And a deputy prosecutor from Bucks County named Michelle Henry, who was assigned to the Montgomery County District Attorney's Office as a favor, as a loan to Kevin Steele for this trial. And she was this fabulous prosecutor. She was asked afterward at a press conference after the verdict last night, as a woman, are you offended by this? And she said, as a prosecutor, I'm offended that the state's top law enforcement officer would break the law and commit perjury. And she said, it's a disgrace.
Good word. Kane didn't testify last week, and her defense didn't call any witnesses. Had to be a bit of a surprise. What was it like in the courtroom, and what was the buzz when, you know, the defense didn't call any witnesses?
I you know, there was a buzz about that, and people were really surprised. I wasn't, because I've covered a lot of trials, and I've seen that tactic before. It is not that uncommon. Where, you know, the defense will, you know, rest on the burden of the Commonwealth, to come and say the Commonwealth did not prove its case. And they particularly do that when the defendant, they don't want to put the defendant on the stand. And they did not want to put Kathleen Kane on the stand in this case. They could not put her on the stand because Michelle Henry would have eaten her alive. So would Kevin Steele. I mean, they really had so much information. It would have been impossible for her to get through that without, you know, taking the Fifth Amendment, most likely. But I've talked to some attorneys about it who believe that it was a mistake to not put on any defense because in cases where you really don't want to, you know, put on a full-blown defense, you can still put up 10 or 12 character witnesses to say she's a great mom, she's a good person, she goes to church, you know, whatever. And to try to paint a picture of her that would give the jury at least a touch of empathy for her.
We have, this just came out over the wire, official statement from the Pennsylvania Democratic Party saying this is a sad day for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and a sad day for the Kane family. So that's the statement from the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. And, you know, again, Brad, and I don't want to get into too much of the past, because we'll do that when we talk about the book. But, you know, Kathleen Kane was a rising star. I mean, all before the Philadelphia Inquirer story that you referenced, she was being pointed to as, you know, possibly governor of this state, a U.S. senator, that, you know, people just looked at her as being a rising star. And I don't know if I can recall anyone whose star fell so quickly and so far as Kathleen Kane.
I can't. I've never seen anyone's star crash like hers. And it was just incredible. And she was riding so high after her first year, which is a really good year, 2013. And I think part of the reason is, you know, look, she was this fresh face who came in. She got more votes than Barack Obama in that election she ran in 2012. People just thought that this woman was going to be fantastic. And I think her first year she relied on listening to the advice she got from people around her, like Adrian King and others. But after that, she went off on her own. Someone convinced her that she was not getting good advice because she was so flabbergasted by that sting story. And I know that King believed that during that first year that look, you know, this great press you're getting is not going to continue. It is just not going to continue. There's going to come a point, no matter who you are, that you get a negative story. Maybe not quite as, you know, as bad as the sting story the Inquirer did, but you're going to get hit when you're in office. And I think she just, you know, couldn't accept that.
You know, Brent, and, you know, I can tell this story now. I didn't publicly or on the air while it was happening, but one of her first press people, spokesman Joe Peters, had made, we were trying to make arrangements for her to appear on this program. And we went back and forth. She wouldn't do it if we would take phone calls. That she said that she told Joe Peters that she's afraid of mischief, of people calling in and being mischievous and having some criticisms and negative calls, and she refused to do it if we took phone calls. And I said, well, that's the format of the program. The governor of the state takes phone calls. The attorney general certainly can, too. But I think that just goes to show that there was more there. She was so concerned about how she was perceived publicly and criticism and that kind of thing.
And I think that was the beginning of what we then saw. It became full-blown paranoia on her part based on the testimony we heard, like having Josh Morrow, this political consultant, search for a wire and, you know, to take his keys and his wallet out and everything else before she would meet with him. In August of 2014.
Brad, the judge did something in this case that you've covered a lot of trials, as you said, but I thought this was a little bit unusual. Not only did the judge order her to give up a passport, that's not unusual, because she had gone to Haiti with her sister and a couple other people in the midst of all the controversy, but the judge admonished her to not retaliate against anyone. And again, that's something that you would seem to think would be reserved for a hardened criminal, the judge telling the attorney general not to retaliate.
Yeah, and I can't convey to you the impression that made on everybody. You had to hear, it's one of those things you had to be there, you had to hear Judge Wendy Demchik Alloy's tone in the courtroom. It was so stern. She was angry at what had happened during the trial. That's my opinion, but her tone seemed to indicate that. And she just said in no uncertain terms, if you, you know, by your own hand or otherwise in any way retaliate, you're going to be incarcerated immediately, is how she put it. And she said, do you understand me, Ms. Kane? And Kane responded, yes, Your Honor, I do. And it was chilling that you knew the judge meant it.
Well, and one of the reasons that the judge did that, I'm sure, is that, you know, the attorney general has been sued and, you know, there have been other legal actions taken by those that said that they were retaliated against for either testifying against her or that she suspected of not being loyal to her. So, Brad, what happens next? Does she resign? Does she have to resign?
That's the big question. She does not have to resign. with a felony conviction until that conviction is final, and it's not final until sentencing. If you'll remember, the judge set up to 90 days from last night for the pre-sentence report and then to sentence her, which comes out to sometime in mid-November. Well, now remember, her term only runs till the early mid-January, let's say, effectively through the end of this year. So that would not remove her till then. You'd have somebody who is convicted by a jury of these felonies and crimes, arguably, you know, against the people of Pennsylvania through what she did, remaining in office, and that to some people is scary. I think, you know, the pressure is going to mount. Governor Wolf was out last night with an immediate statement calling for her resignation. He had before, but this was really strong. I heard the clip from him. Look, the Democrats do not want her in office. You know, politically, it hurts them. The Republicans don't want her in office. You know, they want to take her out, but she can stay there. And the question is, will she on her own resign? Interesting point. As last night news conference, talking to Gerald Shargel, her Manhattan defense attorney, he was asked, will she resign now? And instead of saying no or denying it, he said it's an important issue to Pennsylvanians. And he said, we'll sort that out over the next few days. So he didn't discount that possibility. Because here's what's going on, I think, is that I think the legal advice to her might be, and I'm no lawyer, it's not pure legal advice, it's more political advice, but it would be, look, you have to resign now, and that will help you at sentencing. You're less likely to get a severe sentence if you're no longer the attorney general and you stayed in and fought it till the last day. So I think that might be what's going on. It'll be an interesting week to see whether that happens.
And there's a press conference called by her first assistant, Bruce Castor, later today. So we'll see what happens there, too. Pittsburgh Tribune Review columnist Brad Bumstead, he covered the trial. And his new book is Keystone Corruption Continues. The first book was Keystone Corruption. Keystone Corruption Continues, Cash Payoffs, Porngate, and the Kathleen Cain Scandal. Brad, we'll talk to you about the book a little later this week if you have time, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Thank you, Brad Bumstead. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Up until 20 years ago, a diagnosis of AIDS seemed like a death sentence. But then a concoction of drugs known as antiretroviral therapy helped to control the HIV virus that causes AIDS. Today, those who are HIV infected can and do live long lives. But there are still way too many HIV-positive Americans who are not on antiretroviral therapy, actually about 50%. In the meantime, there are 50,000 new infections a year. This week, a program at Penn State Hershey's Medical Center will launch the expansion of their Opt-in for Life social media campaign to reach those at risk. Joining us is Dr. John Zerlo, Director of Infectious Disease Training at Penn State Health. Dr. Zerlo, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Yolanda Edrington, who is Community and Patient Engagement Supervisor with Hamilton Health Center in Harrisburg. Ms. Edrington, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Dr. Zerlo, you kind of have been there, I won't say from the very beginning, but very close to the beginning when we first learned about AIDS and when AIDS was starting to spread throughout the United States and other countries around the world. I want to talk about then and now, but let's start with the Opt-in for Life campaign. Describe what it is.
Well, I think the challenges you've kind of laid out are exactly correct. We have these great treatments, but the fact is that fewer people than we'd like are really engaged in that treatment. And so if you look at what we call the continuum of care, that is to say people diagnosed, people in treatment, people on therapy, and then ultimately people fully controlled, that's a small number. We should have, you know, 90, 100% of people with these great therapies. The therapies can be as simple as one pill a day, fully controlled, and people can live a normal life. But if you look at those numbers, just as you point out, less than half are on treatment, and probably only about a third are fully controlled with respect to their HIV. Now, if you look at the problem even from a different perspective, which is young people, that is youth and young adults, they're even worse off in terms of getting diagnosed, in terms of getting linked to care, in terms of being on treatment, and ultimately being fully controlled. And so therein lies the problem. So what opt-in is all about is recognizing the following, which is that our sponsors for this project, which is HRSA, and through the Ryan White Care Act, they recognize also that this same group of youth and young people are very engaged in social media. And so they said, gee, why don't we try and harness that? Why don't we use social media in such a way to grab these people, youth and young adults, to bring them out of the shadows into care, get them diagnosed into care in a much bigger way than we're already doing that. So we envisioned this project and we decided, well, we can't do this alone. We want to do this in a collaborative fashion for the entire Harrisburg area. So we collaborated now. It's not just Hershey Medical Center. It's Pinnacle Health. It's Hamilton Health Center. And it's Alder Health Services. We are the providers of HIV care in the greater Harrisburg area. So we launched this project and to use social media to bring youth and young adults into this project. And that's what we're preparing for, our launch of the Opt-in for Life campaign.
And we'll talk about more specifics in just a moment. But the big question is why? Why are so few people getting tested, getting the treatment that they need?
I think the answer is at one point, you know, you get diagnosed. Just as you point out, it was, well, 100% of people didn't die of AIDS, but well over 95% of people did. And then suddenly we had this big change. So suddenly we had treatment. And over now the last 20 years, treatment has become so much easier. We went from, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 pills a day.
Yeah, I used to work in concoction, yeah. But cocktail was what was used most often.
And now there are a variety of pills that we have, what are called fixed-dose combination pills. So all the meds are in one pill. They take it once a day. And for many, if not most, there's no side effects. And it effectively brings their HIV under control. So, you know, HIV is not the disease of the week anymore. I think for a lot of people, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And I think especially for young people, they're sexually active. They don't want to be thinking about these things. Or in some cases, they think about it and they said, well, HIV, it's not such a big deal anymore. But the fact is, it is a big deal, especially if you're not in treatment, especially if you're not controlled. And when we see people coming in with late stage disease, had they shown up even 6 or 12 months earlier, we could have them on treatment and they can be completely healthy. And more importantly, if they're not controlled, then they're continuing to spread HIV.
See, that was the thing I was thinking about, is that it can be spread to other partners out there without their knowledge if they think it's a big deal. What about stigma? I mean, it used to be that there was a stigma about it because of all the reasons you mentioned, but does that still exist?
Very much so, unfortunately. And I think that keeps people in the shadows. You would think we know so much about this infection. We know so much about the disease. It's 1981 that it was first described.
Right.
And now here we are, what, 35 years later. And the stigma, unfortunately, exists. It exists here in the United States. It exists everywhere in the world where there's HIV. There's plenty of stigma. Mm. So that's a big problem, unfortunately. It'll remain a stigma until we can cure it, you know? And there's a lot of interesting research and so forth about curing, but we haven't gotten to that point yet, and we don't know when we're going to be there.
Yolanda Edrington, with Hamilton Health Center. Hamilton Health Center has been one of the leaders in central Pennsylvania in the Harrisburg region with on the HIV AIDS front. A lot of testing, you know, people coming into to the health center. Just what Dr. Zerlo described, what do you observe from people coming in? Are they young? Are they older, middle-aged? Do they have that stigma? Are they in denial? Just what?
I have to agree with Dr. Zerlo. The stigma is there. We have the same experiences as other health centers with getting people to be able to come in and get testing. We do, with our outreach initiatives, going out more and more over these last couple years, we're getting to the younger population and get them to be aware of their status, how important it is to be aware of your status. So I think we are making big strides in the area for the youth to come in. We do have our new teen resource center to address that age group that we're missing
20.
A lot. Yes. So we do have that new teen resource center at Hamilton Health Center that makes those addresses those health concerns in our community. It goes all the way out to West Shore, East Shore. We're in high schools. So we are trying to make some really big moves in the area.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was curious. A lot of times young is kind of a subjective description. A lot of times at my age, anyone under 35 is a kid. So, you know, let's identify this a little bit more. When you say that it's a little more difficult to reach young people, probably there are a lot of people who wouldn't think about teenagers.
Yes.
They would think about that, you know, maybe 18 to 30 year, you know, that age group.
And with this campaign, we're focusing on the age 13 to 34.
13.
So that's our young.
Mm-hmm.
We forget. I think a lot of times we do forget about that very young group that are experimental, that are having sex and do not have the knowledge. Because a lot of times, are we even talking about that at home yet at that age? So now with teen resource centers and being more involved in the community, all the different health centers out with doing outreach, I think the youth are being able to have a spot to talk, to go and talk and to go and ask questions. And this information is out there. There's posters hanging up in your school. You know that there's a safe place for you to go to get this information. You can email in and somebody will answer you. So there's a lot of resources that's going out, especially with this social media campaign. We all know we see people sitting on their phone, on Facebook, on Twitter, and that's just the beauty of this Opt-in for Life. You have these four entities, big entities here in the area, you know, Hershey, Alder, Hamilton, Pinnacle, all getting together to reach out to the community that that sometimes we're missing, and that is the youth. So we're having this big focus on health and wellness with the focus of HIV/AIDS through this campaign, where you're getting the information you need for HIV/AIDS, but then you're also getting the overall health and wellness that you need, too, so you have a better understanding on full body.
Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Zerlo, we've established that younger people are the most difficult people to reach. When we say most difficult, at least get them to act. Also understand that we can break it down demographically even further, that young men of color are especially difficult. Why?
I think because for a large part, they're many young people of color are somewhat, not simply not engaged in healthcare. They're a little bit distrustful of healthcare and healthcare facilities and what we're trying to accomplish. So I think that's part of it. I think the one of the other groups we're really trying to get at are men having sex with men. So gay men also somewhat disenfranchised, but especially at that young age. So I think, but I don't want to single out just gay men. I don't want to single out just young men of color. You know, the campaign is really meant to reach the entire population of people in that age group who are at risk. But once again, those two groups in particular are, you know, part of our target for sure.
You know, there are a lot of organizations, agencies, retailers, companies using social media today. How will this be different?
That's our big question, isn't it? How do we get viral? I mean, that's
right.
Really what it's all about. How do we go viral? The way that the campaign is designed now, opt-in, actually it stands for opportunities for prevention and treatment. That's what it kind of stands for. And so the opt-in, sort of the nuts and bolts of it are, we've created a website, optinforlife.org. It's available. And from that site, then people can navigate. They can navigate to testing sites, to one of our four treatment sites if they're infected. And then they can navigate to our social media sites. So we have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have YouTube, Instagram. So all of these sites we've hired a full-time social media guy, and that's what he does. He looks for linkages of information about HIV, and more importantly, creating original content that is relevant to people who are in some way infected, affected by HIV, but I think one of our key approaches is storytelling. We want people, we want to hear their stories. In fact, we're doing a big campaign. We want people to come to us and tell their stories. It doesn't have to be a story about HIV. It has to be a story about life, about, you know, how they're affected by a lot of things, HIV included. So we think storytelling is a powerful vehicle to bring people into the opt-in universe, into our brand. And we obviously are, again, targeting youth and young adults. And, you know, we hope this is one of the vehicles by which we can truly go viral.
And, you know, just what you're saying, that telling stories is something we do. It's part of my job on this program every day. But what it does is it lets people know that they're not alone, that they're hearing other people's experiences. Yolanda, what's relevant? Dr. Zerlo just said, you know, you want to make sure that this campaign is relevant to the people it's trying to reach. What is relevant? I know that's a broad question,
yes.
But is it just what we described, that that there are people out there that are experiencing the same thing, and that the people you're trying to reach can relate to it?
Yes, and to make sure that we're getting the information out there, I think with stories, then people have a more human connection to it, and that it affects them more, and it puts that in their mind, like, let me go get tested. Let me know what my status is. If I am infected, let me get on let me start therapy for it and take responsibility for my health and wellness. I think that's the biggest thing to get out of that, like, you know, you hear these stories, you get connected to it, and it starts the thinking process. It starts the talking and connecting with other people and getting information out there and just making us aware of people infected, affected. We are all affected by HIV AIDS in the community. And that's just a big thing that we have to talk about and realize that we are all affected by it. Period, cut dry, whether we are infected or not, and that's to really start that conversation every day.
What do you mean that we're all affected by it?
Whether you know someone or you think you don't know someone, you do. And people should be able to talk about their health and wellness with their family members, with their loved ones, without facing that stigma that's out there and being so scared for someone to know, being so scared to go to a clinic and be able to get the therapy that they need. And that's how we're just really all affected by everything that goes on around us. And, you know, not talking about it really makes it hard for the patient. And then we miss those people that need to be in therapy or just need to talk and get more information about being safer with the different acts that they're doing.
Have you had experience or observed at Hamilton where someone hearing a story came in, hearing someone else's story, and decided to come in and get tested?
Yes, absolutely. We have our awareness events at Hamilton, so we put everything on the forefront. And then, you know, we offer testing during awareness events. And some people will come and get tested, and they'll ask questions. But within a week, then we'll get phone calls in, or people will stop back in the building and want to talk because they've heard the testimony, or they've gotten to meet people at an awareness event, got to meet the providers there, and get to, you know, just engage a little bit, and then they come back later on to really talk in depth about how these things affect them.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're discussing during this portion of the program a new social media outreach program, Opt In for Life. I shouldn't say new. It's been around for a while, but it's being expanded. And this is part of Penn State Health and several other organizations, several other institutions and facilities that are working on it. Joining us today is Dr. John Zerlo, Director of Infectious Diseases Training at Penn State Health, and Yolanda Edrington. I'm sorry, Yolanda, that I don't know. I have your name enunciated here, and I'd rather just have it Edrington, who is the Community and Patient Engagement Services Supervisor, I should say, with Hamilton Health Center. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You also can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. To learn more about this issue, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health. From policy to personal choices, we're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system. Online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. You know, when we were talking about the reasons that there are especially young people who don't get tested or may not follow through with treatment, something that just crossed my mind, I don't know if it's as big of a problem today as it used to be, but that is money. That there are people who probably look at this and say, you know what, even if I test positive, I can't afford the treatment, so I'm not going to even bother. Does that happen?
I think people perhaps might have that perception, but the good news is that there are programs set up to assist people in paying for their treatment, actually. The good thing is HIV and AIDS care is very generously funded, mm-hmm. particularly in the region. So all of the four sites that are part of the program were all funded through the Ryan White Care Act to provide both direct patient care and as well as case management services to the population. But there's really, in addition, there's a whole a program set up in collaboration between the feds and the state to provide the large share of what the cost of HIV care is, which is, of course, the medications. Medications are expensive. We don't have a single person in our program who is not covered by one program or another to pay mm-hmm. for their HIV medications and much of their HIV care. So that's the advantage. I mean, that's what we're trying to kind of leverage. The fact is, all four of our sites were all funded to do this work. So money should not be an object for these individuals. And so, you know, for any listener in the audience, money is not the issue. We can help you with that.
Mm-hmm. And Yolanda, at Hamilton Health Center, you're a little bit different anyway, but mm-hmm. Do you have people who come in, say, or maybe don't come in because they're afraid it's going to cost them something?
We try to make sure that people know that the financial part, they don't have to have that concern with. When they come in, the intake specialist will go ahead and go over the special pharmaceutical benefits program, which will pay for the medications. We fill out the application for you. The pharmaceutical companies, they have their own financial services that are out there. And we'll be able to take care of all those issues for you when you come in. If the financial part is your biggest burden, we'll do that research for you and get those things covered when it comes to care.
Mm-hmm. You've touched on it a little bit, the two of you, about the status of HIV and AIDS today. And I want to go back a little bit and talk about history in a few minutes. But, you know, one thing that has changed, Dr. Zerlo, just in terminology, used to be that when we talked about this, we would use the word AIDS more often than we would use the words HIV infected. Today, it's almost exclusively HIV infected. Was that done on purpose, and is there a reason for that?
You know, the terminology AIDS still exists, and really from a public health perspective, we still term people having AIDS versus HIV without AIDS. But in the era of effective treatment, it's almost immaterial, to be perfectly honest with you. We see people who come in with AIDS, meaning their HIV has progressed to the point that they've gotten very sick from one of these complications, these AIDS complications.
Yeah, there infections. Is no AIDS disease. By the I mean, 30-some years later, we're not talking about a single disease, correct?
Well, all I can say is when people with HIV have enough damage to their immune system that they become, their immune system is so weakened that they become susceptible to these secondary complications.
Right.
We call that AIDS. But that's the beauty of HIV treatment. We've seen people, we take people who come in with severe immune deficiency, severe complications. And as I often say, they're not just going to survive, but they can recover to full health. So that's the beauty of the antiviral treatments that we have. So in the past, if you got to the point of being so sick with AIDS, chances are you're going to die. Now you have a pretty good chance, hopefully, if we catch you early enough, again, not only to survive, but to return to normal health. And what was their AIDS, now they're working full time. They're doing all the things they want to do. It's amazing.
Are there people still dying of AIDS in this country?
I'm afraid so.
Why?
You know, as much as part of this campaign, they show up too late. They come in late. They have a complication that we can't ultimately fix and get them better. The antiviral medications don't work immediately. It takes some months for them to experience what we call immune reconstitution. And as a consequence, if they come in too late, they can die. And that's the as I call the tragedy of AIDS, that they don't have to die.
Mm. When did that change?
Well, I mean, in reality, it probably changed when we had these new medications beginning in the mid to late 90s. We didn't appreciate just how powerful the effect would be. And really what's changed over the last 20 years is not the model of treatment. The model is the same, which is we use at least three medications on people. What's changed is the medications have gotten easier. They're combined into one pill, and they're much better tolerated. That's really the big, big change that's occurred over the last 20 years. So they really work well.
You said earlier, sometimes with no side effects. That's unusual, isn't it? I mean, even aspirin sometimes has side effects. Isn't it unusual that a medication doesn't have a side effect?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, we should be grateful.
I don't think they're complaining, but the people who are using it, but still.
I'd have to say the majority of our patients, in our programs mutually, in the four programs, something like 90% of the people who are in care are on treatment. About 90% of them are uncontrolled. They're fully controlled. And it's amazing. And the majority of them just take it. I have so many patients, they take it. They don't even know they're taking a pill. So, all of these things would so favor people just saying, gee, let me get into care. It's great.
Let's go back to the mid-1980s when you first got involved in this. I mean, obviously, from what you've been describing, it is a different world out there today. And actually, when you think about it, AIDS brought about a conversation in this country and changed a lot of people's behavior. I mean, I remember at the time, when the it was first publicly suggested that condoms being used, it was like, oh, my God, I can't believe that we're telling young people about condoms like they didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. But that we're encouraging. There were people who would say, well, we're encouraging them to have sex. This disease really did change our society in the past 30 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's certainly gotten us into these kinds of frank conversations. And if for no other reason, it's a public health problem. It's a communicable disease. And for a communicable disease, we need to bring in public health approaches to it. So as we say now, for people who are successfully treated, whose virus is, as we call it, undetectable, fully controlled. So if they're fully controlled, consistently on medications, so the combination of fully controlled plus consistent condom use would make them virtually uninfectious. They're no longer infectious. In fact, just last week, very provocatively, a group of researchers internationally has suggested that that just being fully controlled would make people's infectiousness, quote, negligible. So that's still a bit of an issue because the implication is that if you're fully controlled, then you're really not sexually transmissible at all. You can't transmit the virus. I think our approach is we're still very much advising if you undetectable, consistently on treatment, and you use condoms, the chances of infecting someone are nil, which is wonderful.
Is that what is referred to? Because as I was reading about this, I said mm-hmm. that some of the treatments even today can prevent the spread of HIV. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, once again, prevent. We clearly know that people who are fully controlled, their risk again is negligible in terms of transmission. Will that truly prevent? We're still trying to understand that. So once again, the message is treatment plus condoms and you could live a normal life.
Mm. You know, this is the grant, and we didn't even mention that the amount is $1.2 million coming from the federal government. You mentioned Ryan White's name, and I think about how much things have changed. Ryan White, for those who don't know, if remember back to the 1980s, who was, you know, told he had to leave the school he was in because he had gotten become infected through a blood transplant, and they were afraid. The parents were afraid of their children being. We have come a long way, mm-hmm. when even how society views this. Would you agree with that?
Well, once again, I'd have to say yes and no. I think people now. I think we've become more comfortable with it. People aren't as afraid of those kinds of things, you know, their children being around somebody who's HIV positive. I think that's all improved, and because we're comfortable with it in that sense. But once again, the stigma still exists. If you're infected, right. Everybody's concerned about confidentiality. People don't want to that other people to know it, and so I'd have to say the answer is yes and no.
Mm. We're talking about Central Pennsylvania specifically, as well we should be, but in Africa. For example, you know, when HIV and AIDS was under control in this country to a large degree, it wasn't in Africa. I don't know if you have any knowledge whatsoever about what's happening in other countries around the world and on that continent, but is there any good news to report there?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest changes that's occurred in the last, say, 15 years since the problems of worldwide HIV infection in underdeveloped countries like sub-Saharan Africa, since that really sort of got on the headlines and gotten people's attention, the start of initiating antiviral treatment in all of these countries has taken off in a big, big way. And so, you know, something like 15 million plus in the developing world are now on HIV treatment and experiencing many of the same benefits that we are here in the United States.
And that is real
huge
progress.
Huge progress.
I mean, I remember when former President George W. Bush, in a budget, I guess it was a State of the Union, he said he was going to wanted $15 million to fight AIDS in Africa. And like the world was shocked, or at least people in this country were like, first of all, politically, but then secondly, that United States was going to make an effort that to help fight AIDS in Africa, and it sounds like it's worked to a great degree. So, all right, let's go back to the Opt-in for Life campaign. Yolanda, what do you want to see? What do you want to see out there? What do you want to see the result of this campaign?
I want to see people being aware, more people coming in for testing, people getting into treatment and staying in treatment. That's what I want to see.
So how can they do that right now? If someone is listening to this program, they've been sexually active, they want to get tested. How do they do that?
They can come to three of the sites actually do testing. You have Alder Health Center, who does testings on Wednesday evenings. You have Pinnacle Health, the REACH program, who does testing Monday through Friday from 8:30 to 4. Then you have Hamilton Health Center that does testing Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30. So you just come into one of the local facilities and get tested, get the counseling. So the testing, it's just not you come in and get your testing and you leave. It's a whole counseling process, too, to make sure that people understand safer practices, that we're there to be able to answer their questions that they may have, and then also to test them so that they know their status.
What goes into testing itself?
So we have a few different options. So you have the OraSure. These are all oral testing that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. the OraSure, and that's a cheek swab. And then that goes to the lab, and then you get your test results within a week to 2 weeks. So we go ahead and give you a call and bring you on back in for your test results. Then there is the OraQuick, which is another oral swab, and you go through the counseling process and also the test, and within 20 to 45 minutes, you'll be able to go ahead and talk about your test results.
So there is no blood drawn or anything?
There are blood draws.
Okay, I
yes,
wondered
yes,
about
yes.
that. Yeah.
A lot of people prefer their oral testing people don't want to get do the blood draw, the needle. Yeah. Some people are scared of that. So there's other options. So I like for people to know that there are other options to the blood draw, and especially the Oral Sure and the Oral Quick, for you to be able to get your test done.
You know, we talked about who you're trying to reach with the campaign. Something we haven't mentioned, traditionally what has happened is that HIV, AIDS was spread through sexual contact, but also the use of intravenous drugs. We know that we have a heroin problem in this mm-hmm. state and this country. Are we seeing more people who are becoming infected by using dirty needles?
We are certainly seeing some of it, but that's still a small percentage of the infections. The new infections, almost all of them, are sexually transmission, mm-hmm. sexually transmitted, either male-to-male sex or male-to-female sex. That still remains the big issue.
Okay. We only have about a minute or so left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. As I said, this program, the Opt-in for Life campaign, is expanding. The launch actually comes later this week. Dr. Zerlo, talk about that a little bit.
Let me actually, Yolanda, because okay. she's really been right. involved okay. in that. In
the Opt-in for Life launch is on Friday, the 19th. At the Susquehanna Arts Museum from 4 to 7. And then the after party will be at the District, which is a lounge, which is right down the street from 7 to 10. It's a fabulous event. We're going to be able to celebrate life, talk about health and wellness with the focus of HIV, the whole campaign about our social media. You'll have our stories up. You'll see our site. You'll get to talk to staff and mingle around. It's such an exciting day. If you're able to come out, check out our social media pages, and just come and join us and learn.
Well, we'll have, as I said, Opt-in for Life is a website. We'll have a link to it right now, but then we'll have a link on our website once the expansion does actually occur. But I hate to say it sounds like a good time Friday night, but if that's what it takes to get people paying attention and mm-hmm. get involved, that's what we'll do. Dr. John Zerlos, Director of Infectious Disease Training at Penn State Health. Yolanda Edrington is Community and Patient Engagement Supervisor with Hamilton Help Center. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking about mental health a little bit tomorrow. Project Transition, helping those living with a mental illness. That's coming up on tomorrow's program.